Thank you very much, Werner, for your introduction. Thank you for you all to be there on Saturday morning. This is an empirical proof of what Heidegger says in the introduction to metaphysics, namely that German are the metaphysical people, because to have the will to be there. I should also I'm very grateful to Gunther and all the friends that realized this meeting. And this is not just a formal way of saying thank you, but a substantial, since it's the third day of the conference. So I had the way to see how profound, useful from a scientific point of view, and the warmth, psychological ambient was this kind of conference. So many thanks for the invitation an sich, and for the invitation as such. Thank you very much. But last premise, an apology. Apology for speaking English. For two reasons, apologies for to speak English in since we are in Germany, and apologies to speak English this way because it's not a good English, but I have no other way to do so. And imagine this is an ontological constraint, maybe an epistemological too, but basically an ontological. So. I imagine that I changed a little bit the title of my presentation, was Can Antisemitism Be Metaphysical? There can be even clearer what is the goal of my presentation. When we have to do with antisemitism in the Black Note, are we matching a metaphysical antisemitism or with the antisemitism of a metaphysician? This is the problem. And of course, my opinion is that we have to do with the latter. It would hope that my presentation will justify this thesis. Before becoming extremely serious thing, I would have something which is not so serious or dramatic. You are depressed. What are you working on? On a book on Heidegger and fascism, just what the world needs, another book about Heidegger and fascism. And as you know, this is Irrational Man of Woody Allen. This recalls me that I possibly put the wrong presentation, just a minute, because I made some slight change and I want to, this is will be very complicated. Apologies. No, this is another part of my philosophical activity, namely speaking about this kind of devices, but uscita forzata, maybe. I succeeded. Because there was two different presentation, and this opened the number four, whereas I have a more advanced. This is a trick of. This should be. Uh, Well, anyway, I hope that is the right one, and otherwise it's not dramatic. It was just a little bit more intelligent, but also stupidity is a part of philosophy. Visualize. Thank you. Here we are again. So this was the beginning. What I will present now will be divided into, five parts. Antisemitism, the question of what kind of antisemitism is Heidegger. I just put the name in German in order to give some Gothic attract to my presentation. So the second is Pharisaism. I would say that the problem of Heidegger and of the most of tradition that precede Heidegger and also follows Heidegger is Pharisaism, namely the fact that we put our moral value not in the action we do, but in the thought we have. And this is very clear, for instance, in Heidegger, when he said that the true action is the thought. I believe that is a typical Pharisaism in thought. Then I will try to look at what is the origin of this Pharisaism, which is not anti-Semitism. It's something rooted in a tradition which has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Da Serbe, how works this Pharisaism in the heritage of Heidegger, which is also important because, for instance, I believe that any one of us always wonder how is possible that someone who was rector Nazi in Freiburg in 1933 and then was anti-Semitic, etc., was the leading figure of the leftist thought, at least in Germany, at least in France, in Italy, in United States. How is this possible? And Die Zukunftigen, and this is also an homage to Die Beiträge, what can happen from this inheritance of Heidegger in this situation? Antisemitism. There is, as we know, an Heidegger's secret, but is a strange case of secret. Seemingly, when he told to an assistant once this expression, "I still haven't let the cats out of the bag, die Katze noch gar nicht um den Sack gelassen," and seemingly it was referring to the black notes, because the problem is what kind of cat was in question. Surely not the Nazism. The Nazism was something perfectly known by all people who have to do with Heidegger. We know that Heidegger was very reductive again his engagement in Nazism, but the mystery of this kind of black notebooks, supposing that Heidegger really decided that they were published after the end of Gesamtausgabe, because we have no textual proof on this point, is an historical hypothesis. Bonn is like the Germany of Bonn will not be. Will not survive more than Weimar Germany, and when the black notebooks will appear, there will be a different situation in which the real meaning of my work can be understood. Note that we all know that Heidegger has a taste for the secret, a relevant taste for the secret, and if you read the Beiträge, more or less, in the black notebooks, the reference to the secret, to the secrecy, is always present, to be secret in the thought. And for instance, there is a kind of irony. We know that in 45, Heidegger, in the same time, under trial in Freiburg, but rehabilitated as philosopher by the French. Beaufré, later on the humanism, René, the filmmaker, make a movie to Heidegger, Tovarniki went to the Black Forest, and in the letter of on humanism, Heidegger writes Die Heimatlosigkeit wird ein Weltschicksal, which now, you know, means the Jews have won the war, because Heimatlosigkeit is the character of international Judaism in the analysis of the black notebooks. So there is also a kind of Gideon irony in this. There are all these sophisticated Frenchmen who went to the Black Forest in order to rehabilitate the old Nazi, and he says, die Heimatlosigkeit wird ein Weltschicksal. And in this sense, the use we have to do of this book is like a Rosetta Stone. Black notebooks are a Rosetta Stone that explains the real meaning of all this secrecy present in the published work. I remember, as I was young, of seminars in which people were discussing for 2 days about one single word of Heidegger. I believe that now, with the black notebooks, some of them, for instance, Heimatlosigkeit, can be explained. Of course, not all, but there will be, in this sense, the idea of making a lexicon of Heidegger is very useful also because with this kind of document, the lexicon became much more evident. It has been said, well, there is anti-Semitism in Heidegger, but is a metaphysical one, a metaphysical anti-Semitism. I have many doubts about this formulation, because in a sense, he likes to say that Goering had an aeronautical anti-Semitism. Of course, Mengele had a medical anti-Semitism. This is, in a sense, is pretty clear, pretty obvious. In another sense, it's more serious, because you can also say of Hitler that his anti-Semitism was metaphysical. For Hitler, its anti-Semitism was metaphysical, was grounded on metaphysical principle. You can say that anti-Semitism is metaphysical in many cases, not just the case. If you are metaphysical, you are metaphysical in every part of your life. And now, if I am a metaphysical, say it's 1120, this is a metaphysical sentence. This is a not sense, a true sentence, by the way. The idea that metaphysical anti-Semitism is, in a sense, grounded is a much more profound book of Derrida, of spirit, in which he said, as we know, there is this passage in which he says Nazism is not born in the desert, Nazism is a forest in which all the religion, the culture, the world of the spirit is rooted on Nazism. Of course, is a true consideration, but if we say, like it's usual to say, also Hitler, also Hitler, maybe, but also Heidegger, Hegel, Kant, Luther, and so on and so forth. Clear, we can make a list of personality of the culture who were anti-Semitism, but there are differences among them. Still, there is a difference to be anti-Semitist in the Middle Age or in 35, for instance, and especially became a kind of folgeschichtlich determinism. If you are German, if you have a kind of culture, if you have a history behind you, then you should be anti-Semitic, which is not the case, because the Dreyfus case happened in France, Auschwitz was in Poland, and Thomas Mann, which at the beginning had the same kind of German root of Heidegger, ceased to have this and was a severe critic of all this. For instance, with this kind of auto da fe, which is also Dr. Faustus, is also a criticism of something that he perceived as an inner problem. So, I would say that we have not to speak with a metaphysical anti-Semitism, but with the anti-Semitism of someone who was a metaphysician. But in what part of his life he was a metaphysician? In all its life, take this interesting quote, which has nothing to do with Heidegger. It's a passage of Mon Coeur Mis à Nu, of Baudelaire. He says, "A pretty conspiracy to organize for the extermination of the Jewish race, the Jews, librarians and witnesses of redemption." This is a tragic sentence, as you can imagine. Pichois, the editor of Baudelaire in the Pléiade, says, "This is a sentence difficult to interpret," and add, "Any anti-Semitism is to be excluded." Of course, you cannot exclude this anti-Semitism. A way of saying, well, it's not real anti-Semitism, could be it's a poetical anti-Semitism. If you say, well, it's a poetical anti-Semitism, sounds better because it's less severe, you know, the poets, ver gross denk, ver confused. We have all a list of justification on this point. But my opinion is this. This is not our work. This part of Baudelaire, this fragment of Baudelaire, is not a work of Baudelaire. The poetry of Baudelaire is in the Fleur du Mal. The philosophy of Heidegger is in Sein und Zeit, as the literature of Manzoni is in the Promessi Sposi. I say the Promessi Sposi because this book is the most famous Italian writer who wrote just one novel in all his life. Exactly like, this is my hypothesis, Heidegger wrote just one book in his own life, and this Sein und Zeit. If you read of course, there is the publisher of the Gesamtausgabe will be not so happy of say that the other are fake. I'm not saying that the other books are fake. I'm saying that the other book have a different interest and have this interest from this seminal book, which is Sein und Zeit. Because, for instance, The obsession of being a man, a virunius libri, appears several times in the Black Notebooks. I believe that notice this and say, it doesn't matter if I will be a virunius libri. In fact, it matters a lot because it's really in a problem how to go on after after the Sinusite. And same thing with Manzoni, but Manzoni, for instance, and this is the reason why, in a sense, Manzoni is much more sympathetic than Heidegger, did not write anti-Semitic booklets. He just wrote books on the Catholic morals, on the history of Longobards in Italy, and so on and so forth. So that we have not, but if suppose that Manzoni wrote a book, Bagatelle pour un massacre, and they say, well, it's literally anti-Semitism. No, it's the anti-Semitism of a writer. Same thing with Emile, which, as you know, said that the love of a mother cannot be supplemented, and went and sent his, all these songs to the orphanage. But, there is a problem, so to speak, of transfiguration of the commonplace. Hitler transfigurated the humiliation and the fear for the future of the German petit bourgeois and the taxi driver anti-Semitism into a political catastrophe. Heidegger transfigurated the humiliation and the fear for the future of the German petit bourgeois and the taxi driver's anti-Semitism into a philosophical masterpiece, Sinusite. This miracle did not happen in the Black Notebooks, and no act of hermeneutical charity can make it happen. This is simply my opinion. What is important is not to judge the man Heidegger says, well, he's a metaphysician. Yes. The miracle is that someone who was able to make this transfiguration in Sinusite, and he was no more able to make this kind of transfiguration. And the proof is that there are things that happen once in a life. Once in a life, you are able to transform all these pathos and stimmungen and personal problem and historical problem into metaphysics. And this was precisely the case of Sinusite. It's not, there are no things that happen by pure azar. Well, the Pharisaism. As I said, the idea that one's moral value is determined by the belief one professes rather than one's actions. There is plenty of Pharisaism in Heidegger. The most relevant is when he say that thoughts are true actions. If you want to find something which is much more responsible than anti-Semitism, because is something that make it so that there is no action which is relevant, only the thought is relevant, is the idea that thoughts are the true actions, or the true pity is that of thought and should not be wasted on the mechanized agricultural treatment of a people. It's not original, as you know. The extermination of 30 Jews in Poland was baptized Aktion Ehrenfest. Ehrenfest. One can wonder whether it was know or not this situation. Maybe not. And morality in the wrong place. Morality in the wrong place also, for instance, in the kitchen, like Heraclitus. Ethos anthropoi daimon is to say that everything one acts is a kind of moral. No, it's not only something one acts. And also, the Seinsgeschichte is a kind of philosophy of history, and we know that philosophy of history is a branch of moral philosophy. So all this Seingeschichtliche reconstruction of the second Heidegger is a heavy moralistic view on the history of being, that in which the Jews are the pagans of the Civitate Dei. They are responsible for the decadence. And note that most of this idea that was typical of some use of Heidegger in last decades, saying I'm fighting against metaphysics. But what does it mean, really, fighting against metaphysics? What is the risk, for instance, of fighting against metaphysics? It was like a kind of civil fighting, political fighting, and in many cases took was the substitution or the hallucination of an effective political fighting. Someone fights against the metaphysics, whereas he can find them more useful for some concrete right. This is the passage quoted yesterday by Espinet: "Die Wirklichkeit des Wollens ist nur im Wollen dieser Wirklichkeit." There is all this this idea that, so to speak, I would say, you know that there was Alois Riegel who created the concept of Kunstwollen. There are epoch in which the people are not able to create works of art and have just an aspiration to the art. We should also imagine a philosophy wollen, or it also a Wille wollen, or an X wollen, a pure gesture of willing as the basis of your attempt. And in a sense, we can say this is very interesting. If you look not only at the black books, because most of the writing already published by Heidegger, for instance, in the lessons on Nietzsche of the 30 and 40, have this kind of character to make a great seingeschichtliche description, very moralistic description, in which there is a curious, and this is the Civitate Dei, this is the mixture between the high of the history of the metaphysics and the concreteness of something very contingent. Look at this passage, for instance. On the stage, we have Heraclitus, Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, Kant, and Hegel. Behind the scenes, there are Dostoevsky, Junger, Spengler, and who knows who else. And in the dressing room, you have Guderian. This is this famous passage in which, in these days, June 1940, we are witnessing a mysterious law of history, that is, that one day a people no longer lives up to the metaphysic trigger, but its own history, and this happened just at the moment when these metaphysics had changed into the unconditional. Note that there is also a kind of historical justificationism. There is a metaphysical ground for the military catastrophe of France in the 40s. And in this sense, Guderian should be metaphysical militarism. Well, this is the point. What I try to show in the two first part of my presentation is, I'm just looking what I see, was two kind of attitude. The first is what we should consider as antisemitism in Heidegger, and I would say it is the antisemitism is not a metaphysical manifestation of antisemitism, but is the practical historical manifestation of the antisemitism of a metaphysician. How are you able to draw a line between this kind of things and the two metaphysician works of Heidegger. My criterion is the work. I would call in, say in French, an oeuvre. When you have an oeuvre, you are not in the pure antisemitism, you are in the metaphysics. For instance, there is an oeuvre in Seinunzeit, and this oeuvre is able to transfigurate something. When there are only fragments, there you have only ideology, fragmented ideas, nothing special metaphysic. In a sense, is what the opinion of Foucault at the very end of The History of Madness, when he says, well, when Nietzsche became mad, when he chooses to make work, until Ecce Homo is still philosophy, because Ecce Homo is a work, in fact. It's a work, it's not purely a fragmentary. But when you write to Burckhardt saying that it is all the name of the history, of course, this is no more work. Well, the second point was Pharisaism, the Pharisaism, saying this attitude that is not only of Heidegger, but is very diffused among us intellectuals, to believe that what is worthwhile in our life is what we write on the newspaper, what we say at the conference, what we write in our books, and not the action we do. And this is important for me because it shows the possibility, the tradition in which Heidegger inscribed itself, and also the heritage of this tradition. I go on with the Vorlaufen, and it's to me the idea that the simply thinking is like acting is an heritage of the constructivism we find at the very beginning in the moral philosophy of Kant, then in Fichte, then in all the heritage of transcendental idealism. Yesterday we were speaking about productive imagination in Kant, in Kant's book, and this is the productive imagination is the possibility with the pure concept of producing something in the world. This is very clear. Also, for instance, Schelling, we know how Schelling was relevant for Heidegger's Seinsgeschichte, and there is the idea that there is a kind of production of the world by ideas, and this explains why idea seems to be so important in this sense. To me, this is grounded what we can call a transcendental fallacy, namely the confusion between epistemology and ontology. The idea that things exist only insofar I know their existence. In a sense, I think must be able to accompany all my representation became the fact that the I is the possibility of all my representation. Of course, in Kant is not so evident. It becomes much more evident with transcendental idealism. It becomes completely evident in Seinunzeit, when the Dasein is this kind of being in which is included the possibility of all other beings. And there is also, if you want, a complementary fallacy, the Pharisaic fallacy, which make a confusion between axiology and ontology. This is very typical of many philosophical evaluation, also of kind of of acting of philosopher. For instance, one says, is the language important? Of course it's important. Is the language ontological relevant? Yes, in a sense, yes, but in the epistemology, in order to give name to the things and know the things, but it's not the construction of the world. Is not something which is very important for us. So the difference between epistemology and ontology is the epistemology is what we know about what there is. For instance, that this is H2O. And the ontology is what there is. The fact that I know that this H2O has nothing to do with the real essence of this water. That remains water even though I ignore that it's H2O. The Tyrannosaurus Rex, I'm sure, never know his name. It's silly, but it's not. Nonetheless, it had exactly the same properties he had independently from this name. And this is Man is the Shaper of Being, is a part of this. Yes, we can go on the Serb. But before this, I would say that Pharisees obtained the ambiguous gift of omnipotence. Thought only on the desk of their computer. In fact, because there is this idea, and this is the reason why I find relevant an appeal to realism, because if we think that the thought is the real action, that the thing we thought are constitutive of the world, we have an illusory omnipotence, but we have also to manage to someone, for instance, when something resists to us, and this is the character of the reality, you say, well, why this resist to me? This is a typical problem from a transcendental idealist. Why reality resists to my thought? And the answer is, for instance, we spoke of this yesterday, the catechon. The catechon, there should be a navel that resists to my thoughts. The history is blocked by the catechon that could be what you want, or for instance the Jews, but just one of the possibility. And all this is a kind of anti-realism. I mean, to be anti-realist does not absolutely means to be, for instance, Nazi. But in order to be Nazi, you should be anti-realist. This is the famous photograph of Hitler in March 45, looking at the post-war reconstruction of Linz. This was March 45, with the Russian at 80 kilometers from Berlin. This gigantic anti-realism that we see in the last moment of the Third Reich is somehow related to this idea to the X will. The fact that if you really will, you will win. If you really win, only the will counts, and some particularity of the external world, for instance, the economical wealth of United States are not relevant. Why happened this interesting point? This, I would say that Heidegger is a philosophically Lee Marlene, because achieved the singular task of taking to the postmodern slogan terms and concept that belonging to Nazi worldview. This is historically true. I can how this happened. And I will say that this is, again, Pharisaism. Because Imagine that they are right-wing Heideggerians. They are not so much, in fact. They are less right-wing Heideggerian than one supposes. And they follow a right-wing philosopher. They profess right-wing philosophical views. They show right-wing practical behavior. They may be Nazi, I hope not, or anti-Semitic, I also hope not, but they are not Pharisees. There is a coherence inside their attitude. Take a left-wing Heideggerian. They follow a right-wing philosopher, which is without any doubt. They profess left-wing philosophical views. They show right-wing or left-wing practical behavior. So they are Pharisees. There is many ways of interpreting this Pharisaism, and there can be also a very important, a very creative left use of Heidegger heritage. For me, the paradigm is Derrida. Derrida said, what I say against Heidegger derives from Heidegger, which is, he said, well, in fact, I believe that it derives from Heidegger what for Heidegger was a positive mystery, because there was the kind of mysterianism in the Heidegger philosophy of history. Heidegger transformed it into a psychoanalytical matter. Says, well, there is an unconscious of the metaphysic. We have to work on this unconscious. It's an immanent criticism, same thing as for Husserl, but it's a true criticism. In fact, it's a true criticism of Heidegger, so that you can be, and this is the case of Derrida, a true Heideggerian scholar and a severe criticism, a critic of Heidegger. For instance, he openly criticized Heidegger's politics. Moreover, there are many relevant, I would say that there is practically no a part of Derrida readings of Heidegger which is not critical on some passages of Heidegger. For instance, since the very beginning of Fousier et Grammet, and Grammet, when he criticizes this idea of Heidegger of the original temporality, until this very relevant point that was central for the last 20 years of work of Derrida, that saying that animal is mortal exactly like the man. And to say that animal is less mortal than a man is the first step to saying that there are men who are less men than other men, which is, for instance, the discourse he gave in Frankfurt when he obtained the Adorno Prize, is centered precisely on this point. He is not anti-realist, and it becomes, to me, inconsistent only in those cases when he must defend himself through Heidegger. For instance, there is some part which I find problematic, even though the book is very beautiful, in the L'Esprit, especially the end. This end I find ambiguous in the discussion between the Catholic theologian and the philosopher, and depends from the very complex situation of this discussion, because you have on the one side someone who criticizes Heidegger, but you already criticized Heidegger, but in the same time criticizing Heidegger and criticizing you, so you should defend yourself and defend Heidegger is a complicated task. But for instance, I remember very well in December 34 in Paris, Derrida was commenting this passage of Vasseis Denken, in which he says that the ape has no hand, and wondering, where did he see an ape in the Black Forest? In fact, it's a naive questioning, but it's maybe also, where did he see a Jew in the Black Forest? Because one character, we noticed in the discussion of Ben Soussan's presentation, is how the philosopher liked to speak about Judaism, ignoring almost all on Judaism. Also, we don't know what kind of knowledge... So when he says that justice is in the indestructible, which is a dictum that reappears in all the last part of his activity, he says in the same time that reality is unamendable. So it's not the catechon that resists to us, and so you have to imagine imaginary opponents, enemies. That can be the capital, of course, not just the Jew, can be the universal complot. Of course, there are many ways of interpreting catechon, but the unfortunate thing is that it's the reality which is unamendable. But I should admit that I have a special sentimental relation for Derrida, so like a philosophical Che Guevara, so all I said was maybe this is one of the last photographs of Derrida in June 2004, 2 months before the death. Well, there is also a negationism, Pharisaism, which is, for instance, the case of my master, my professor Gianni Vattimo, because he was really deluded by his attitude in this polemic, because minimized Heidegger's responsibilities. First, he said he was not really a Nazi. What does it mean, be not really a Nazi? Not really an anti-Semite. It was interesting, at a given moment he said, it was maybe Nazi, but not anti-Semite. Which is interesting, because it's difficult to be Nazi and pro-Semite. And a Nazi and anti-Semite, but a revolutionary, and the fact of being a revolutionary was... negationism is not innocent. It is really politically relevant to be a Nazi and an anti-Semite. I believe that is not politically relevant. It marks some kind. This is, in a sense, a sophisticated negationism. There is a more basic negationism whose most relevant example was done by Fédier. In my sense, there is this famous passage that Fédier published the political discourse of Heidegger. At the given moment, there is Heidegger who says, to our great Führer Adolf Hitler, a German Sieg Heil. And in the footnote, Fédier say, today the expression Ski Heil, is still used with no political connotation whatsoever, but skiers to wish one another a good ski. I have no other commentary to this point, but I believe that is an example of negationist Pharisaism. It's the same like Bel complot pour l'extermination de la race juive. Any antisemitism should be excluded, like in this passage of... Baudelaire and Pichouin Baudelaire. Well, there is also, but there is, I won't waste my time, and your time especially, also a situationist Pharisaism, for instance, Žižek, who say the Holocaust is condemned to the land of political correctness. The condemnation of political correctness is a moral value, as Heidegger himself told us. Radicalism required that one supports, in theory at least, Heidegger, Hitler, and the Holocaust. This kind of perverse form of reasoning which allows Žižek say Hitler was of course, a bad guy, responsible for the death of millions. He definitely had balls. He pursued with iron will what he wanted. Okay, I find it. Situationist because it's typically for a patele bourgeois. One writes these kind of things. Then we have a last kind of Pharisaism. I would call, I have not a precise description for this, but I would call him psychoanalytical Pharisaism. I ask you 3 minutes because it needs three long quotes. The first is this quote on how how dishonest is to make plagiarism. Denied or claimed non-reading is a form of intellectual dishonesty, but it is not the only one. A related and more serious form of it is plagiarism, the thoughtless and relentless thief of ideas, insights, observation. New technologies are not enough to explain it. It is, again, the total lack of ethics in the relationship with the text and with the author. Take a book or an essay and plunder it with copy and paste. So, without much hesitation, you pass it off as your own stuff. What is the point of quotation marks? So, imagine the scene of Pharisaism. Your moral value depends from what you say as valuable, about what you say and not what you do. We find this in a recent book of Donatella di Cesare, Heidegger and Sons, at page 41. Could be interesting in this sense. Read what we find at page 49. Again, apologies for for the length, because in the second version I tried a way to make it shorter, but the disciple consciousness, even more so if she is a female, grateful to the master, is an unhappy consciousness. For when she starts to speak, or better, when she resumed interminable and silent dialogue with the master, his questions, his answers, although the master didn't want to have the last word, she feels herself indefinitely challenged or rejected or accused by the voice of the masters that speak within her and before her to reproach her for making this challenge and to reject it in advance, having elaborated it before her after all. She would then be forced to remain an infant, that is, not to speak, only this unhappiness stems from the fact that she hides from herself. In academia, as in real life, the master, like the father, is always absent. When I read this passage, I thought, well, this recalls me something. This is not new. The disciple consciousness, when it starts, I would not say to dispute, but to engage in dialogue with the master, or better, to articulate interminable and silent dialogue which made him into a disciple, this disciple's consciousness is an unhappy consciousness. Starting to enter into dialogue in the world, that is, starting to answer back, he always feels caught in the act, like the infant. He feels himself indefinitely challenged or rejected or accused by the master who speaks within him and before him to reproach him for making this challenge and to reject it in advance, having elaborated it before him. This interminable unhappiness for the disciple perhaps stems from the fact that he does not yet know, or is still concealing from himself, that the master, like a real life, may always be absent. And this is, as you know, the beginning of of Derrida's criticism to Foucault. Of course, for me, the interest is not the plagiarism, it's the Pharisaism, because it's very clear that the fact of having criticized the plagiarism at page 41 allows a real plagiarism at page 49. This is the interesting matter. I would not say that this is also responsibility of Heidegger. Be clear. It's not as Heideggerian that this happens. But this explains the other point. So why people with political idea apparently very different from Heidegger could have used Heidegger in a creative way, like Derrida, in a less creative way, or in a no creative way, because it's a plagiarism. Well, this is Kontikin. Kant will still be Heideggerian, was the question by Charlie Hebdo some weeks ago. I would say the answer is, of course, thank you, Radezon, but I would say this is not saying you. We cannot be Heideggerian. It's avoided to be. It's verboten. Kein Heideggerian mehr. No, this is not what I would say. Also, because, for instance, Heidegger's left-wing luck began in 1945 when he was being tried for Nazism. The only point is that some Heideggerian will not think much of this Bagatellepura massacre, because we have to consider what we read sometimes, because it is obviously is in some passage of the Black Notebooks, is a kind of Bagatellepura massacre. We have to consider this, to have this in mind in each moment we read Heidegger. This was Coyne yesterday suggested that we should always be aware of this point, a point of which we were not aware at all when we were reading Heidegger, because I never suspected, because that a sentence like Heimatlosigkeit wird ein Weltschicksal could be an anti-Semitic sentence, because in itself is just a criticism of globalization, for instance, as not immediately this kind of meaning. One more point to come into the end. This is not a critics to Heidegger, not a critical to Heideggerians, but a consideration, in a sense, a critical to we all doing this kind of strange work of thought, and that imagine sometimes that thought is the true action. Is, if you want, an historical fact and an experiment of thought. Here the historical fact. This man, Dimitar Yosif of Peshev, was a secondary politician in Bulgaria. It was the vice president of Bulgarian parliament in March 7, 1943, he was informed by a friend who was Jew that the Nazis were preparing the deportation of all the Jews from Bulgaria. And he wrote a letter to the prime minister, obtained the signature of 43 other parliamentarians, became a scandal, the deportation take not place. imagine how simple it was. It was a patient in Netherlands, a patient in Poland, a patient in Italy, a patient in France. This was not an intellectual, it was a high bourgeois of the Bulgarian elite. And this makes it so that there has been no Jews deportation in Bulgaria. And this is also, it is a kind of of movie heroes, a Spielberg heroes, could be Donovan of The Last One, or Schindler, someone, man without qualities and without thoughts, that acts something that effectively changes. And here we come back to the experiment of thought. What if, instead of a letter of the Prime Minister, he'd written his thoughts in a black notebook? Many thanks.